Ba 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 ba. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Movies on the Brain podcast. I am one of your hosts, Ryan C. Wood, and with me this evening on the other end of this Zoom call,
Chad Mintz.
Welcome to another weird, wild, and wacky week in the world of genre movie news. For a very long time, for 10 long years, we were promised an Indiana Jones sequel. Many times on this podcast, we doubted whether old man Harrison Ford would live long enough to see Indiana Jones 5 become a reality. And lo, here we are in the year of our Lord 2023, where all of the rest of Hollywood seems to be burning to the ground. We have finally had an Indiana Jones 5. Chad, walk me through our dial of destiny.
Well, I can guide you the best I can because I'm blind because I still haven't seen it yet. I know a little bit about it. But before you go into in-depth about the movie, what do you think about how it's doing after the first weekend?
I'm efforting for us to get somebody from the Producers Guild of America on our podcast because I want somebody who is trained in big budgets to explain these things to us so that we and our audience can have a better understanding of what these figures actually mean and like how they get to these particular points where like an Indiana Jones movie costs $300 million after marketing. You know, I'm interested by this and by the fact that like we did this song and dance after the first weekend of Elemental, which we all like pronounced dead on the scene the same weekend as Flash, and lo and behold, day in and day out afterward, it got good legs and it started making its way toward profitability. It's going to cross $100 million domestic. It's going to end up probably somewhere around $150-200 million domestic, and that's a win for Pixar, especially considering audience behaviors and everything that was going on before this particular film came out. How do you get to like COVID plays a factor in the international marketplace, filming in the international movie during COVID with all the restrictions and everything that's going on factors into it. And actor salaries, you know, can play a part. I'm sure Ford, you know, wasn't exactly looking for a huge payday off of this, but, you know, you do have to pay Phoebe Waller-Bridge. You still have to pay other people. So I am pleased with the $60 million opening weekend that it did, especially for the target demographic. What I'm not a fan of is the posthumous hand-wringing and bemoaning and Paul Revere, the British are coming type reaction to this movie and what it means for cinema as a whole and franchises as a whole and Disney as a whole and all of these bold proclamations that we're making about studio films based off of this weekend, this one movie. You know, you can make a case that it's collective and that we're talking about Disney slate as a whole this year and the amount of money they spent on movies, the amount of money they spent on marketing and how they haven't turned profitability. But like, I feel like Dial of Destiny is being a whipping boy for a conversation that is much broader than just this franchise or this movie.
And I would agree with that for the most part, particularly the Disney aspect, because they've been spending the most on these movies, and most of them have been, because of the budgets, have set the movies up to be failures. I do think Elemental is, like, since you brought up Elemental is a like a good sign for them in the fact that it has like held really well. But again, everything that's sinking all of these movies is the budget, and I really hope you are able to get a producer here, because when I heard the budget for Indiana Jones, I'm like, again, I haven't seen it, but for why? $300 million for what? I thought you could make a Indiana Jones movie on a modest budget. Like $100 million seems like a thing Indiana Jones should be able to do. $150 million would be pushing it to me. 300 before marketing, that just it. I just cannot see why we're there. I do know that, you know, it's a period piece, so that, you know, you got to make the sets and all that kind of stuff. But it seems like something nowadays when you think of budgets, you think and you see them that big, it's because of effects and like computer effects. And you would think that Indiana Jones doesn't have as much outside of the de-aging that we know happens. But yeah, it no matter the quality of the movie, the fact that it was a $300 million budget, it always made it hard for it to be profitable. So I would hope that Disney was prepared to judge it different ways, or it just shows that they overestimated, thinking that, you know, it's Indiana Jones. If it's decent, it'll make money. But even decent isn't going to get you. I mean, you make a $300 million movie, you have to make $1 billion in it. And that should never be anybody's goal. Unless you're an Avengers movie, $1 billion shouldn't be the goal.
Well, an Avengers movie or an old school Star Wars movie. But like, those are the only things that I think of with $300 million budgets. This was $300 million after marketing, I want to say. It was like $240 million before marketing. And then with the $100 million P&A spend was $340 million, I believe was the number I saw floating around. That's still an insane number.
It is.
The COVID stuff does factor in there. International shoot, testing precautions, masks for everybody. Like, it was a much more complicated thing than shooting a movie now or before COVID. The issue they also have is that Dead Reckoning Part 1 comes out this week, and that movie is similar in scale to what Dial of Destiny is, and they have a lower production budget. And there's something wrong when the seventh installment in a Mission Impossible franchise costs less to make than the fifth installment of an Indiana Jones franchise.
Right. That is crazy.
But I mean, like, making bold, deep proclamations about the state of the industry because of one movie. Like, I didn't see people, like, the reaction to Flash was more about DC and about whether or not or how much the James Gunn hard reboot hindered that movie, hindered Shazam, hindered Black Adam. How much of it was the bad publicity around Ezra Miller? How much of it is superhero fatigue? How much of it is the lack of a marketing campaign or presence? Like, those were the questions that are being asked after Flash. I don't feel those are the questions that are being asked after Dial of Destiny. I think Dial of Destiny is getting lumped in with Ant-Man, the Wasp, Quantumania, and some other films that Disney has put out that haven't made a ton of money lately and cost a whole bunch of money to make. And it's being used as the catalyst for a narrative that is, you know, the industry is dying. And also it's being used as the catalyst of no one gives a shit about Indiana Jones anymore. And I don't necessarily think that's true, but I also think that they didn't do the Star Wars thing with Indiana Jones that they like. Dark Horse Comics did an Indiana Jones series for a while. There are, as I've talked many times on this podcast about the journal and the tie-in movie tie-in novels, novelizations, and all kinds of different things. There's a whole series of books. It had its own expanded universe run the way that Star Wars did. After Disney took over, none of those things happened. And as we keep pointing out on this podcast, you know, Indy 5 was announced the same day as the sequel trilogy. And in the intervening 11 years, like, Star Wars has gotten a lot of material, ancillary and main line. And like, Indiana Jones has gotten none of it. Like, there hasn't been a new set of novels the way that you had the Aftermath series of Star Wars books to talk about the period between Jedi and Force Awakens. You didn't have the line of comic books. You didn't have the animated series. You didn't have any of these things to keep Indiana Jones in the consciousness of the public from 2008 on, and really from 2012 on. And this is, you pay a price for that at a certain point, because there are a generation of kids who don't know who Indiana Jones is. That, you know, as much as we all love Raiders and as much as we all love Last Crusade, those aren't replayed on television as much as the Star Wars movies were or are. Like, Disney did not do a great job of maintaining a cultural awareness of the icon that is Indiana Jones, and then just expected everybody to get excited and flock to a theater because an old man decided to wear a hat, a fedora again.
Okay, that's true. But then this is kind of different, but kind of the same. But people would argue that, you know, we've made fun of Avatar for having no cultural relevance. And I would argue that Indiana Jones has more cultural relevance than Avatar even now. But, you know, James Cameron rolls out of the bed and it's like, here, take this 3-hour blue people movie and it makes $1 billion. Nobody should have expected Indiana Jones to make $2 billion like Avatar, but it seems like there should have been enough resonance, even without them like actively cultivating it, to do bigger numbers than it looks like it's going to do. I think that would be the argument that people would make.
But every time that Cameron rolled out of bed, he was talking about Avatar 2, 3, 4, and 5. He was constantly updating his progress on the scripts. He was constantly updating his presence in shooting. He was constantly updating cast list. Like, he went out, they re-released the movie at a certain point. Like, they made an effort to, like, Cameron himself personally made an effort to let people know, hey, these are coming. And yeah, it took him a decade to get there, but he never stopped talking about it, and they never stopped putting stuff out about it. Like, you didn't even hear a ton once the movie started filming. It wasn't like there were a ton of, like, you know, they were shooting out in the open, but there wasn't like there was a ton of, like, paparazzi shots of Harrison Ford with his bullwhip. You know, we've seen more from Brave New World with Harrison Ford sitting in a director's chair and pointing and laughing at Anthony Mackie than we ever got from any of the stuff from Dial of Destiny. And it's just, you know, there's also the fact that those Avatar movies are inherently cinematic. Mm-hmm. They are spectacle pieces. You cannot go on Disney Plus right now and watch that movie and get the same visceral reaction and the same visceral understanding of that film that you did when you saw it in cinemas. You just can't. You can't replicate that experience.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones, for all of that it has been, has never been a spectacle piece. Like, even the big train spots or train chases or the Hindenburg scene in Last Crusade or the plane escape at the beginning of Raiders, or, you know, the opening of the Ark of the Covenant, or any of these big moments that you've had in Indiana Jones films, none of them have really been cinematic in scope to where, like, I have to go buy a ticket to go see it. And I think that has definitely hurt the film in terms of, like, if you're going to compare it to Avatar, you can't, because, again, it's just, like, that CGI, yes, there's long gaps between sequels, but there's an inherent bait to get people into the theater to see it, whereas there's not really a hook like that to see an Indiana Jones movie, except say come say goodbye to the old man, he might die tomorrow.
Like, I want to say I agree with all that. I actually think I do agree with most of that. I mean, my only qualms were actually earlier, and you kind of squashed them a little bit with, you know, how there we didn't get a lot of activity when they were actually shooting the movie. And I was going to say that, you know, that stuff only really affects us because we, you know, we're in this kind of stuff. We look for that kind of stuff. It wouldn't affect the average person that's going out to see it. But I mean, just to your overall point, I don't know. I like that this whole thing is, I really thought it would do better than it has. I don't think it's like you. I don't think it's done bad. But even if you take the budget out of it, I thought it would have done a little bit better. I thought it would push, I don't know if I'd have said, thought it would have pushed 100. I thought it would have, you know, like 80 was probably where we would settle in, and that it would be, it's Indiana Jones, it would be successful. I didn't think we'd get to the point where it's Indiana Jones is going to be a flop. So it is taking a lot of criticism for Disney in particular, but big blockbusters in general. And that is not fair, but I do. I think it's ultimately, like, right now, I think ultimately what's doing it, and it's going to be the budget and then it's going to just be, I don't, the theater experience hasn't gotten back to like a pre-COVID level. I don't think we've still gotten to a level where we know what the new normal is. I think we're still figuring it out. All we know is people will come out and will support movies that they want to see, and they will make a lot of money. But I think, like the median movie, I think the days of, you know, having like $3, $4, $5 billion movies in the summer, I think those days are gone. I think studios are going to have to reevaluate stuff and spread these movies out, because what Elemental is showing us, they can leg out. They can't, like, we've gotten used to movies making all their money in the first weekend and then kind of fading, fizzling fast. I think we're seeing the return of legs, but you've got to give them space to leg out. And you got to control budgets. So to that effect, I'm curious to see what the legs on Indiana Jones is. If it has legs, then I think it's, hopefully the studios take the lesson that we have to shrink our spending on these movies and space it out to give these things money, give these things room. Because if we give them leg room, they will leg it out and make us money.
I'm old. I may have some short-term memory loss. Wasn't there a film called Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 that came out in May?
There was.
Isn't there a movie called Oppenheimer that's supposed to come out in a couple of weeks?
Right.
Isn't there a movie called Barbie that's supposed to come out in a couple of weeks?
Right.
Do you know what the current projections are for Oppenheimer?
I do not.
$40 million. Do you know what the opening projections are for Barbie at this moment?
At this moment, no.
100 to 110.
Okay.
Guardians opened with over 100 million.
But if you remember when it came out, that was initially seen as an appointment. Because it came out to 114, and that was under what Guardians 2 did. And people were expecting it to open over 140. So the first week, everybody was wigging out. But now here we are. It's over 800 million. I think it's made more than the second one. Again, legging it out. And I don't know what Oppenheimer's budget is. I don't know what they're expecting from that. But 40 million seems, for that type of movie, I think that's, and that it's opening against Barbie, but they are like, this is the definition of counter-programming. I don't think one is going to hurt the other. But again, having two major releases in the same weekend, we haven't had that in a while.
In the month of June, you had Transformers Rise of the Beast. You had Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. You had The Flash and you had Elemental. And I feel like I'm missing something up in there. But like,
Transformers, Flash, Elemental came out the same week. There was a gap, and then it was Indiana Jones. I think that's right.
But that's a lot in one month.
Mm-hmm. That is
old school.
And it's they have to recognize that it's going to change. One of the best things that happened was that Marvel decided to kick the Marvels down in November months ago. So people don't even know that they're missing it in July. It was supposed to come out like next week. Or hell, might be like supposed to come out like tomorrow. The days of crowding it all, because everybody crowded into summer. It's their most profitable time. But again, movies were making all of their money in the first 2 weeks. That was it. You made 80% of your total box office in those 2 weeks. Now it has turned. The fact that Guardians is still playing right now and still making money, it's telling you, Into the Spider-Verse jumped back up to number one a couple weeks
ago. Was also a June release.
Right. That's the other one. Yeah. It was the first one. That one in like week six, somewhere around there, it was probably week four, jumped back up to number one, and it's still legging out. It's still going, it has a chance to beat Guardians domestically this week. So it looks like legs have returned. People aren't as front-ended on going to see the movies. They're willing to wait and space it out. We can talk about box office stuff like that for a while, because at some point when we talk about it next time, we'll have to discuss home release and streaming stuff, because I think they need to rearrange that window too. But we can get to that later. We can get back to indie now.
As we sit here and you've seen Asteroid City and I have not.
Yeah. Well, I actually went to the theater to see that one. I don't know if it's on home release or not. But
yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It had Wes Anderson's highest single weekend ever, opening weekend ever, because they put it in more theaters than ever. And yet, the very next weekend, they announced the VOD date for it. Like, it was out in theaters for a week before they announced the VOD date.
See, I knew the numbers, I knew that it fell a lot, but I didn't know it was on VOD, and that would explain why it fell a lot. So, one day we'll have this discussion about VOD and streaming and how they do that and what needs to be done about that. But let's get back to indie. So, how do you want to do it? You want to go full spoiler like we usually do? And
Yes. This is for all intents and purposes now, this is the Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny spoiler cast.
All right. So you heard it. This is a spoiler cast from this point on. If you haven't seen the movie, if you don't want to know anything about the movie, now is your time to check out. We'll see you next time. If you're still here, we're going to carry on with the way we normally do it. I want to get your initial thoughts, and then we'll go to your good, bad, and not so good. So initially, what did you think of the movie?
This gave me the ending that I needed 10 years ago. Marion and Indy get married at the end of Crystal Skull, but there's so much about Crystal Skull that you just try to burn out of your head that it doesn't leave, that ending doesn't leave you satisfied. And that ending also comes with him picking up the fedora from Mutt and just being like, nope, I'm still going to keep doing this. And so it doesn't feel like a cathartic ending. It just feels like him flying the middle finger at everybody and saying, I'm going to keep doing this. Whereas this feels like a complete cathartic ending. It is not as quote unquote fun as Temple of Doom or Last Crusade. It's dealing with some very weighty, heavy things. I'm glad they brought Phoebe Waller-Bridge back on to write this script or help write this script, because God help me, I don't want to know what the original version of this thing was, because Mangle does not seem like a happy dude. And no. most of his movies don't seem to portray happiness. I mean, 310 to Yuma, not great, not a happy film. Logan, definitely not a happy film. Ford versus Ferrari, not a happy film. The guy's resume doesn't just scream, joyous, hopeful pieces about humanity. So I'm glad that they brought in Phoebe Waller-Bridge to pump up the script. And I'm glad that they put her on screen, because her character is a lot of fun and brings a lot of energy to every scene that she's in. But overall, my thought was just this is the kind of Indiana Jones movie I wanted. It's not the greatest action movie you're ever going to see. It's not going to redefine the genre the way that Raiders did so many decades ago. It's not going to, make you laugh out loud all the time the way Joyride does this weekend. It's not that movie, but it is funny and it is a lot of fun and it is action-packed, but it's also dealing with some adult themes that I think are very relevant, especially to this character at this point in his life. So that's my overall thought. And I've seen the movie 3 times now, so.
3 times, I can even see it once. All right, okay, so.
Have a life. You have a life and a job where you have to work more than 3 hours a day. So you have less time than I do at this point in my life, sir.
That is true. Unfortunately, that is true. All right. Well, now that we've got the general thoughts out of the way, what is your good about this movie?
His performance. He genuinely seemed to care about the performance he was putting on screen. He did not mail this one in. He gave it everything he had. I don't know if it was just Mangold, the different approach from Mangold compared to Spielberg. I don't know if it's the script. I don't know if it's just his burning desire and passion to go out in a better role than what he did in Crystal Skull. I don't know if it's just his age and this is what he wants to be remembered for. But that Harrison Ford gives a fantastic, moving adult portrayal of Indiana Jones. And it's weird because it's a hybrid performance, because of course the first 25 minutes of the film is Harrison Ford de-aged, and it works really well because Lucasfilm is, you know, the best in the business at that. But this 42-year-old looking man opens his mouth and the voice of an 82-year-old grumbles out of it. So it kind of pulls that punch. They were able to get away with it with Tarkin because you can take old dialogue that was, you know, recorded in the 70s from that actor Cushing and you know, clean it up and put it into the new script. You can't really do that here, especially when you're creating a whole series, a whole set piece from cloth. There's no dialogue you can pull from the other three movies that are going to work for this particular set piece. So you have to get him to record new dialogue. And I'm sorry, the man doesn't sound the same as he did 25 years ago. Just doesn't. And that's natural. The de-aging is good. It's still not perfect. But it's passable. And again, I'm not somebody who is like overly thrown off by the Cushing Tarkin thing in Rogue One. So maybe my opinion is a bit skewed on that, but like he gives an amazing performance in this film. There are action beats. He is still asked to do action beats, but the funny part of it was to me is that he even acknowledges in the film itself, I got bad shoulders. I got bad knees. Like I got bad hips. Like I should not be up here climbing on these rocks with you. Like what the hell am I doing here? Like he literally says that, and he literally acknowledges that. And that is something that I am very grateful for, because this isn't the 42-year-old version of him that's, you know, running from a group of tribes and people at the beginning of Raiders, or, you know, that is, punching Nazis in the face off of a tank and while hanging off a tank in Last Crusade. This isn't even the Indiana Jones that was, you know, floating down the river in the Jeep. Like, this is a different dude. And I appreciated the honesty about that. But my good for this film would definitely be Harrison Ford's performance. Secondary good, of course, to, as I said earlier, to Phoebe Waller-Bridge's dialogue and the way that she punched up the humor for this script, because I really appreciate what she's been able to do for major franchises. And now we'll get to see, I guess, whether or not she can make a Lara Croft movie work.
I keep forgetting that's what she wants to do next, or that's what she's going to do next. All right. Well, since I think we'll talk more in depth about some of the other stuff in these next categories, what was your not so good about this?
I forgot to add John Williams' score into good. John Williams' score is just profoundly amazing. And I saw someone with a screenshot on Twitter this morning of like the credit for his very first movie from like 1960 something, and his credit from this is like his book ending credits. And you know, it was the idea of everything that was in between and in the massive catalog that he has and the legacy he's gonna leave behind is just hugely rich. So I appreciated that and definitely would put the score into my good. The not so good for me would be Mads Mikkelsen. Mads is like asked to do some very interesting things as a Nazi, and he has some of the most uncomfortable dialogue scenes. You can feel the Hannibal Lecter-ness in him in a way. Like you hear some of those dialogue scenes and you're like, he portrays that kind of creepy dickish assholeness that you need from a Nazi while also giving off the smarts of it. But like, he doesn't start off as a Nazi commander. Like, he's not a position of power within the Nazi regime. He's just a scientist dude, basically. And I think that kind of, to me, undercuts the ending of the film, or it undercuts what he's doing, his ability to be the main antagonist in the film, because it's like, this dude's just a scientist. Why are these dudes, like, following him as an occult leader? Like, dude was, like, 17th on the command chart. Like, you know, what are we doing here, fellas? I mean, but like, his performance is a mixed bag. There are really great moments in there, and then there are really bad moments in there. And like, you know, there are other Indiana Jones villains I would put ahead of him, certainly. I think Donovan from Last Crusade would definitely be ahead of him. So would Belloc. from Raiders would be ahead of him. Mads, to his credit, would probably be ahead of Cate Blanchett's character from Crystal Skull. But like, it's an uneven performance for me. And it kind of was like, I wish he could have done more, and maybe there was more on the cutting room floor. But yeah, that would definitely be my not so good, would be Mads Mikkelsen's performance.
So you're the first person, I mean, I haven't looked I haven't really tried to look, but you're the first person I've seen like really mention him. So knowing what kind of movie this is and the fact that people haven't mentioned him, I figured it was going to be something like that. Not that he would be bad, because I don't think Mads can be like terrible in anything, but that it would feel, you know, kind of mixed.
Yeah, because I mean, like, you go from so one of the angles that I really like about the Ginny and Jones franchise as a whole is that they incorporate real historical moments and events and characters into this universe and into this story. The welcome home parade for the Apollo astronauts plays a big role in the first major action set piece after the de-aging of the film. Like, Indiana Jones on horseback rides past Neil Armstrong, Buzz Lightyear, Buzz Aldrin, and Alan Shepard, the three astronauts that walked on the moon, he rides past. This is not all that different from, you're talking about somebody who literally, within the first season of Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, like within the first two episodes of the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, he meets Theodore Roosevelt in Lawrence of Arabia. So, I mean, it's not like this dude hasn't interacted with famous historical figures that just randomly happen to be in the same area as him. Let's not forget, dude has a journal signed by Hitler. So, I mean, it's not like he hasn't interacted with large historical figures before. It just, like, that scene and that set piece is important, but it's like, you use that, you use Archimedes, you use Greek mythology, you use history. The first artifact that pops up in the film is the Spear of Christ, which is, you know, we deal in biblical historical artifacts a lot in the Indiana Jones franchise. You deal with the Ark of the Covenant, you deal with the Cup of Christ, which is the Holy Grail. And this, at the beginning, you're dealing with the spear that pierced the side of Christ, which, if, you know, you're going to go on the assumption that the early, like, when Christianity really takes off and people realize, you know, hey, that guy was the Lord and Savior, you know, maybe some folks would have been like, hey, let's kind of track down some of these artifacts from that whole, you know, Golgotha thing. They might be important to us in our heritage. And so you can, like, totally see, like, people chasing it, like, people trying to figure out who the centurion was who drove the spear into Christ's side and what they would have done with the spear. You know, you can see realistically how that artifact like that would have come into being of historical importance. And I tie that back to Mads' character in the sense that Mads' character is a repurposed Nazi in the American government, to the point where, like, he's going to meet the president in some secret bunker somewhere and get a medal because he helped get the engines right on the Saturn V rocket that launched the astronauts to the moon, because he took his science that he learned as a Nazi and applied it to NASA. And so that, of course, makes him a good guy, not a really creepy dude whose science was used to murder people. And so I really love the fact that they don't pull the punches, and they actually talk about the historical relevancy of what happened to the Nazi scientists, how some of the Nazi scientists ended up on the American payroll, and how some of those Nazi scientists helped create some of the major technological breakthroughs that we had in the 20th century. And so I was happy about that.
That is good. I don't remember it in the first two, but I do remember the, you know, the Hitler thing in the in Last Crusade. Yeah, so hearing that, you know, that there's an interaction with, like, a real life event, that feels very Indiana Jones, just Jones-ish. And I'm glad that they did the whole, you know, Nazis working for the Americans thing. Because a lot of people don't know these things to be true, and sticking them into movies like Captain America did, and this doing it, you know, sad but true that this is a way some people find out about history. So I'm glad since they decided to stick with Nazis that they went this route with it. All right, so
I really love the line. You should have stayed out of this, and yeah, and you should have stayed out of Poland.
I get that one. All right, so
and it works, and it just works so much better. Like Temple of Doom is Indy being Fortune and Glory. Temple of Doom is Indy just literally on a quest because these people at this tribe that took him in when his plane crashed need some help. It's literally just Fortune and Glory and just like a thing. Ark of the Covenant, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and Last Crusade are about Nazis and about the occult and about trying to accrue the historic artifacts for the Fuhrer. And you know, that is a very real thing that definitely happened. And he's at his best as a character when he's standing up to, you know, the Nazis. And it doesn't work the same because communism is an ideal. It's not, you know, communism was like terrorism in the sense that communists didn't run around America with, you know, the sackle and, you know, on their sleeves. They didn't identify openly as communists. That was why McCarthyism became such a huge paranoia event, because like, it's the idea that anybody could be a communist. Your next door neighbor could be a communist. Your kid's teacher could be a communist. You know, it's that kind of, you know, thing. Whereas with Nazism, it was very black and white. Like Nazis literally still to this day run around with flags. We see them. We the flags and tiki torches, man. Like they don't hide who they are. They proudly display their swastikas. And like that makes for an easier good versus evil depiction than communism, even if communism is like putting on a bad Ukrainian accent and running around with a sword.
I'm glad that's what I was gonna say. I'm glad that Indy has showed us the way to treat Nazis is just to punch them in the face, and that continues to be a trend. And hopefully people see this and like, hey, he fought Nazis back then, he fought Nazis later as he's an old man, and it's always the same thing. They may take their different shapes and forms, but if they're Nazis, punch them in the face. And sadly, that is still, you know, relevant to us here today.
Yeah, and you know, the other part of that too is the occult and the Fuhrer. And the amazing thing about this is the event that takes place that gets the events going takes place at the very end of the war, where Hitler's in his bunker. Like the war is almost done, and yet here are these Nazis still trying to put this thing on a train to get it to the Fuhrer. Like they didn't stop up until the very end. It was still all about the Fuhrer and all about the mission. And you know, and then the whole bulk of this movie is about trying to attain a device that theoretically could send you back in time to, you know, help correct the mistakes that Hitler made. You know, because if you have the knowledge of history, because A, you lived through it, and B, you know the outcome, if you go back in time, butterfly effect, right? You mess with everything anyway, right?
Right.
But if you could, you know, tell Hitler, hey, you might not want to just stop at Dunkirk. You might just want to, you know, keep pushing them into the sea and then go and do this and do that. Like, if you know where his mistakes were and you can go back and tell him, then maybe instead of losing the war, you win the war. And Mads' character has a line in this movie toward a World War II veteran, a black World War II veteran, by the way. He's like, y'all didn't win the war. Hitler lost it. And if that's your approach, and then you want to go back in time and help Hitler win the war, you know, it's not killing Ike. It's not killing Churchill. It's just having the knowledge of strategic battles of where you lost and helping them to find the winning strategy. And that's just the definition of, you know, endurance. Like they don't just stop being Nazis. They don't just wake up one day and decide, you know what, that Hitler guy was crazy. I'm never going to think or do anything about that ever again. Like it's a thing that continued in their lives well after Hitler was dead. And, you know, they didn't just stop being Nazis because Hitler killed himself. And I think that that, you know, the modern day stuff in this movie takes place in the 1960s, toward almost the 1970s, because it was July 20th of 69, right, that the man walked on the moon. And it was a month that they had to wait for quarantine. So it was August of 69 when they had the parade. So you're talking about the late 60s, early 70s, and they were still around. And they're still around today. And it didn't stop just because we won the war.
Right. So we got the good, we got the not so good. So what's the bad? What didn't you like about this movie?
What's our boy Zola, the computer dude?
Toby Jones.
Toby Jones. Toby Jones is in this movie, both in the de-aging part and in another part in the film. Not a great performance. Doesn't give the unhinged vibes that I needed from that particular interaction. I could have used more of him and of that character to really flesh that out. As far as like my bad for the movie would be Crazy White Man. They literally have a dude here who like is assimilating to Nazi culture. He's learning German. He's having blatant disrespect for African Americans. He literally just shoots people. Like, homeboy's supposed to be on a quote unquote secret mission, and he's just killing people. And when his CIA handler is like, "Bro, you can't just be killing people," he looks at her and just basically flies her in the finger, and then later shoots her. Like, the whole thing ends with the point of, so the dial itself, what it does, or what is alleged to be able to do, is to give you the directions to a rip in space-time continuum where you can fly through the rift and enter into the portal of your choosing. So like, you can go through the portal and come out in Pearl Harbor in 1941, if that's where you want to go. Or you can come through the portal and you can go to Sicily in 1931, or whatever you want to do, right? That's the idea of the dial. And really, realistically, Mad's character doesn't really do much. He takes very much a Donovan approach and lets Indiana Jones take all the steps, and then basically takes the thing from Indiana Jones, and then lets Indiana Jones go, and he finds the other part to the thing, and then he takes that thing from Indiana Jones, and then he lets Indiana Jones go, and Indiana Jones gets the last thing that he needs, and then he takes the last thing that he needs, and then he takes Indiana Jones with him on the plane, because finally he just holds him hostage for reasons I don't know. And so once they have the dial assembled and it's pointing them in the direction of these coordinates, they go into these coordinates and they come at, like, they have this moment where, you know, Indy is trying everything he can to talk them out of doing this, right? He's powerless. Like, his hands are tied, literally. Like, he can't fist fight his way out of the situation. All he can do is appeal to Mads Mikkelsen's characters. Smith, it appeals to Smith's like vainglory that like, your calculations are wrong. When Archimedes made this dial, he wasn't taking into account, he wasn't taking into account continental drift. So, you know, he didn't account for that in his calculations of these directions. Your calculations are off. You're going to fly into a black hole, yada, yada. Almost works, doesn't work. They fly through. They fly through and they end up in Sicily, but they don't end up in the Sicily of World War II. They end up in the Sicily of the Battle of Syracuse from the Peloponnesian War days. And when I say my bad is old homeboy, it is because at this exact moment, when you have flown through a hole in the space-time continuum, you look out the window, you see sail ships and catapults and people in swords with swords in sandals, your first reaction is not to try and turn the plane around. Your first reaction isn't to try and help your boss with the current situation because he's losing his mind because now he's stuck here and he doesn't know how to get back. Your first reaction is to go up to the gunnery and take the gun and just start raining fire and bullets down on the people of ancient Rome who have no idea what you are and are calling you a dragon because you were just randomly firing a gun at Archimedes and his people for no reason. This is not going to help you. It's not going to help you get out of the situation. It's not going to change the outcome of the situation. No, no. You're just going to randomly, weirdly, crazily just start firing your gun at anything that moves. It is very weird. And you're going to laugh maniacally as you do it. It's also very crazy.
All right. So is that your only bad of this movie?
Yeah, because I'm not mad at the time travel aspect of it. So like a lot of the complaints that I've seen before I saw the movie, I saw a lot of people referencing the fact that they took a really big swing. And I saw the film and it just didn't register with me that like this would be a big leap, that the big conclusion of the film would be that they go and they time travel. Because like, again, I'm an Indiana Jones fan. I've seen Indiana Jones at like age 10 take a picture with Lawrence of Arabia and like scour like pyramids with Alexander with Lawrence of Arabia, or go on a jungle cruise safari with Theodore Roosevelt, or you know, run into, you know, name historical figure A, B, or C. Like it doesn't, seeing Indiana Jones and Archimedes on the same beach doesn't blow my mind and seem like something that is completely out of place within the context of the franchise. It just doesn't. And so I didn't consider it a big swing. I liked it because I liked that it was a twist, because the idea is that Archimedes built the dial, but Archimedes didn't build the dial to allow the bearer to travel anywhere in space and time he wanted to. Archimedes built the dial to bring help to his people so that they could win the war. So it was a false deck. You never really had the option of going anywhere else but Sicily during the Peloponnesian War. So, like, I like that, like, that twist on it, that even if this brilliant Nazi scientist would have gotten everything exactly right and accounted for every variable, he was never going to end up in 1930s Sicily. He was always going to end up here. And I like that twist because, to me, it means that it didn't matter whether his calculations were right or wrong. He was still going to end up in this particular place. And again, Archimedes and Indiana Jones sharing screen together didn't bother me at all. The same thing with the whole let me stay thing. How many time travels movies have we seen, Chad? How many times have we been told that, like, if you stick around here, you will muck things up and change the course of history? And in fact, the funny part about it is they show us throughout the film that what ultimately is the climax of the film does change history. For example, like, it's, the Peloponnesian War days. Clocks won't be invented for thousands of years, much less watches. Yet when they discover the body of Archimedes to help get one of the last pieces of the dial together, what is the body of Archimedes wearing? He's wearing a watch. How could he possibly have done that? Well, because we see him in the scenes in the past picking up the dead Nazi's watch and putting it on. So, like, they show us time and time again that, like, there are real-world impacts to, like, technology from a foreign time showing up centuries early. There's, like, consequences for people staying where they shouldn't be. And we've known that. Like, that's in every, you know, Marty McFly's whole family was disappearing while he was trying to play Earth Angel. You know, there are consequences for you sticking around in a place where you're not supposed to be for too long. So I didn't mind the whole let me stay thing, because it's like it fits the character's mindset. Also, we hear repeatedly that Indy is a tired old man, that Indy is does not have much to live for in his mind. His wife is, you know, been inconsolable with grief and has filed for separation because their son died and he has no son. His wife is lost to grief, basically. He tries to teach, but we get a very good parallel with the earlier movies where, like, the students are hanging on every word that Indiana Jones says and batting their eyes at him in all those classroom scenes in all the previous Indiana Jones movies, including Crystal Skull. And here they're just like lackadaisical. They're looking out the window. They're not listening. They don't care. And so it's like, I don't like, I have nothing to live for. Let me just stay here and, you know, die of my gunshot wound and, you know, help Archimedes build stuff, you know. And I even like that part of it. I'm not like, I'm not as hung up on that as some of the others are, apparently.
Well, I can see why they would have this hang up, but I don't know. Just listening to it, I mean, maybe if I see it when I see it, and I'll feel differently. But nothing strikes me as odd as the damn aliens in Crystal Skull. So
you can interdimensional beings.
Thor's an interdimensional being, and by the end of this, everybody just calls them an alien. The aliens. So I mean, time travel. Considering where Indiana Jones starts. Like in Raiders, even though technically Temple of Doom is first one, but you know, in Raiders, there's always some supernatural sci-fi element to it. I don't think time travel is that far-fetched. It always felt like there was like a little hint of plausibility, like there's something else. But like going back in time, I can see why people would have a problem, but it still fits with everything else that's happened. I don't really, you might not like it, but it fits with everything else that's happened.
And it presents him with this moral dilemma. He's shot. He, you know, is bleeding out. Like, he doesn't believe he has a whole lot to live for. I mean, he basically just wants to spend his last days, you know, in a historical period, witnessing history and just dying in history. And like, that's a far cry from the guy we meet in Raiders. That's a far cry from the guy we see picking up his hat at the end of his wedding. But it's him wrestling with the events that have happened in the intervening years, in the last 10 years of his life. Because if you stop and you think about it, this movie takes place in 69. Crystal Skull takes place in 56. That would mean that there's like 13 years of difference between the wedding and this. It would mean that like, he only got, depending on when went into Vietnam, he probably only got like 3 or 4 years with his kid. And all indications in Crystal Skull and in Dial of Destiny are that they had a rocky relationship. I mean, even in Crystal Skull, you see the back and forth between him and Shyla is, you know, pretty pronounced. But think about that. The man didn't know he had a son for 18 years. And then gets a son, and then within 3 years, the son's dead because he wanted to piss off his parents and go sign up for the war. And now Marion's only child is gone because he had a need to piss off his daddy, and his daddy doesn't have the mental or emotional wherewithal to console his wife through that situation. And so that's a lot to emotionally deal with, and you're offered this opportunity to just basically stay here in a place where like history is being made, and like you taught classes about this, and potentially you've written books about this, and you know you probably don't have much life left even if this bullet wound doesn't kill you. You know, that doesn't seem like a bad option to him. And I like that they do the work through the body of the movie to put him in that place so that it's believable when you get there. I yield back.
Okay. Well, okay. I mean, from what I know, you kind of covered everything else. Yeah, you even touched on the Shia of it all, which, just to make it abundantly clear, if you listened to this and didn't care about spoilers, yes, Shia is dead in the new movie. He went off to Vietnam and died to piss off. He went off to Vietnam to piss off his parents and died. I knew that before you even saw the movie, So,
but even him describing that to Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character, the way that Harrison plays that moment is deep and profound with grief. And, you know, they hint at it from the very first opening scene of the movie, because when you get to, or from the first opening scene to the present day, because when you do the dolly shot of Indy's apartment, you know, the one that's seen in the trailer where he wakes up out of the sleep in his chair, the folded American flag with Mutt's picture is right next to it, so that they telegraph to you very early on that he did in fact die. He just You don't get it told to you until Indy tells you in that moment.
Which makes sense. That's, you know, and I didn't know how it played out. I knew he told Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character in the movie. I didn't know how it played out, but I imagined that, you know, Harrison was going to do a good job with it, which it sounds like he did. So all in all, it sounds like you enjoyed the movie.
I didn't go see Crystal Skull 3 times in the first 4 days.
That is a good marker. And that was actually, you know, very smart, because I think I've only seen that thing once, and I kind of just refuse to watch it ever again. So this seems like a recommend for, at least if you like Indiana Jones movies, right?
Yeah. And it's more in tune with that. The sense of fun isn't there. But that's, again, the fun that is there is because of Phoebe Waller-Bridge. It ain't because of Mangold. Like, Mangold's direction is not fun and pulpy and adventure-y in any kind of way. It's, you know, there's been a meme going around Twitter about the sad dad motif that he has in his movies. You know, it's a thing, but it's balanced out with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, so it works.
Good. So,
and again, if you're going to be mad about Archimedes and Indiana Jones being in the same scene together, let me remind you, the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark is a bunch of people opening up the Ark and having their faces melted off. The climactic scene in Temple of Doom is a man having his heart ripped out of his chest while it is still beating. The Last Crusade's penultimate moment is Indiana Jones versus a 700-year-old knight and a Nazi drinking out of the Fountain of Youth, only to have his entire being melt away because he chose the wrong cup. And of course, as you touched on earlier, Kate Blanchett got magically, you know, Close Encounter of the Third Kind away by some interdimensional beings after placing the crystal skull back where it was supposed to go. Like, Archimedes and Indiana Jones sharing the same screen in the Peloponnesian War is not any crazier than any of those other things I just mentioned.
Not at all. It sounds like if you like Indiana Jones, you should really like this. If you've had fun with Indiana Jones in the past, I think you should like this. From what Brian's saying, I know I'm going to go see it now. I'll report back when I finally do. Honestly, for me, my only reservation, and this didn't happen until like today, and it's the whole James Mangold of it all. And that's just because I read it was he's talking about the movie. And of course, somebody asked him about, you know, Wolverine coming back. And oh no, it was about killing Wolverine versus killing Indiana Jones. And his description was so, the man is like, he just likes sadness. And listening to you talk, it just made me realize, yeah, that he really just likes sadness. Cause he was like, I killed Wolverine because I didn't think the character had any happy moments or new love at any point in his life until the very end of Logan. And that was the time to kill him. That was the way to close the story. I don't remember what part he's talking about because, again, I've only seen Logan like once. I don't like that movie, but just that description, like, this, I killed the character when he found love. So he knew love for like 10 seconds and then I killed him. The dude, and hearing him and then thinking about everything else he said about other stuff, the dude's perpetually sad. He likes perpetual sadness. I don't like that kind of stuff. So that's my only iffiness about it, but I'm still going
to
see it.
And that dude, my friend, has been hired to write and direct a Star Wars movie. Make
Jedi sad again. I thought he was done with that, because I would dump him too, because he is perpetually sad.
No, because he was supposed to do at one point a Boba Fett movie, and then they got him off of that, and they put him on that thing that they announced at Celebration earlier this year, which was, I think they put him on the Knights of the Old Republic, if I'm not mistaken, that set thousands of years before the events of the original trilogy, and features plenty of knights of the old, plenty of literal Jedi knights and literal Sith everywhere. So he'll make Jedi and Sith sad again.
Well, yeah, we'll see. Hopefully it'll be good, but I'll report back once I see Indiana Jones and express any other reservations I have about this dude.
This is your reminder also that Fast X is available on demand at any time that you would like to do that to yourself.
At some point, maybe. Not right now.
But for a final thought on Indy, like, I walked out of the theater happy. Like, yeah, I still get the Marion in Indy that I got at the end of 4. But, like, if you look at the journey of their relationship over a 40-year period, they've been through some stuff, man.
Yeah.
Like, they've been engaged. They've been separated. They've been married. They've had a kid together. They've, you know, they've been on the brink of divorce. And now they're reconciling in their old age. And they're going to, for all intents and purposes, the way that not only the box office reception, but just the age of the character, like, he's going to die in the arms of his lover. And that's an appropriate thing for those two characters who've gone through so many ups and downs to end that way, living in a small New York City apartment. And as James Mangold said this week, he could very easily see them going off on some archaeological dig somewhere together in South America or whatever, living out their days as a retired archaeologist. You know, that I can live with. And this movie gives him that. And death, I don't think, was ever on the table because Harrison didn't want that for this character. He didn't give a shit what happened to Han Solo. Like, he begged for Han Solo to die in 1983. Like, he was on record about that. And I love that we've gone through this press tour and just gotten his grumpy old man responses to questions like, who would win a fight between Indiana Jones and Han Solo? Like, I love the fact that we actually have gotten grumpy old man answers from him on those things. But, like he loves this character. He put energy and effort and enthusiasm. He gives a better performance in this movie than he does in the entirety of Force Awakens and the 5 minutes that he's in Rise of Skywalker, because he cares about this character fundamentally in a way that he just doesn't for Han. And so I could never, like, I would have loved to have, like, had a camera in the room if Mangold even had the balls to bring up the idea of killing Indiana Jones and or even leaving him in, you know, Peloponnesian Rome or Peloponnesian Sicily.
Well, according to both of them, well, Harrison was like, you know, the script was already written, so we didn't really talk about killing him, and it doesn't seem like it's anything he was, like, really keen on. So, you know,
I mean, Crystal Skull has that same happy ending with him and Marion. Sure. So, like, it was very clear that that's the direction Harrison would go. And, yeah, well, you know, it kind of makes me sad also that in the 90s, when Harrison was still, in early 2000s even, when Harrison was still, like, a go-go brand name action star, and, you know, that we didn't get more of these at some point.
Yeah, that would have been the time to do them. But
at the same time, you're at the apex of everybody's career. Spielberg's career is at its apex. Ford's career is at its apex. Lucas's career is at its apex. Like, everybody was on a high point during the 90s. So finding the time to carve out to do another Indiana Jones would have been a bit difficult. But I also kind of just feel like they were hoping that the River Phoenix thing was going to take off and they could do a young Indiana Jones stuff. And then, you know, the vampire room or whatever it is in L.A. And then he dies of a drug overdose.
I mean, yeah, I get, because they did the show after that. So, maybe if the river stuff doesn't happen, they're just like, oh, we'll just do a movie instead of this show. And Indiana Jones lives on some more.
Yeah, because the thing about, like, you know, the thing about it is, it's like, that's not a crazy, stupid way to go. I mean, we look at Solo and we say it can't be done. People won't accept anybody in the role but Harrison Ford. But that, I don't think, is the lesson to learn from Solo. I think the lesson to learn is from Young Indy, and that River Phoenix nailed the mannerisms and the action and the tone of who a younger version of that character. He's not playing Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones. He's playing himself as Indiana Jones at 17 years old. And that's a difference, whereas I think Alden Wright kind of felt like he was trying to do his own thing, but also trying to do some forward, and it just kind of came out jumbled.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Plus, you would have gotten River Phoenix on the cheap compared to what you would have been able to pay if they had rebooted before Crystal Skull and they'd gotten somebody else like Brendan Fraser to play Indiana Jones, you're going to be paying Brendan Fraser in the early 2000s way more than you were going to pay River Phoenix in the late 90s, early to mid 90s.
Right.
So, well, that'll about do it. Chad has successfully walked me through the dial of destiny. I'm sure you will enjoy watching Crazy White Man shoot up, you know, Rome for no particular reason. I look forward to hearing his report when he does see the movie. But that'll about do it for this week's episode of the Movies on the Brain podcast. If you want to follow our podcast, you can follow us on Twitter. I am at BCW Tiger Fan.
I'm at The Mets Theory.
Thank you very much and have a pleasant evening.